We are getting back to our series through 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Had a little bit of an intermission after 1st John, took a question night, had a singing. But now we have time and opportunity to look at 2nd John. And we will plan to look at 3rd John after this one. But 2nd and 3rd John are very interesting because they are written in a different style than 1st John. And if you remember that when we started to look at 1 John together, we noticed that 1 John is not really written like a letter. It doesn't tell us who it's from. It doesn't tell us who it's to. Usually when Paul wrote his letters, those were the kinds of things that he started with. But instead, 1 John is written in a way that's very poetic. It's grand and it's ornate. The style of it is a lot more similar to the Gospel of John than it is to one of Paul's letters in a lot of ways. But 2nd and 3rd John are kind of the exact opposite. They appear to be very personal notes that are written to two different individuals. And they're very short. They're just one chapter each. If your Bible pages stick together, you might miss them, flipping from 1 John on into Revelation. They're 13 and 15 verses respectively. But the way that I like to think about them is almost like hurried messages scribbled on greeting cards. You know, when John sat down and wrote 1 John, he composed this beautiful, magnificent piece of poetry. But 2nd and 3rd John was sort of like he had something he wanted to say, and he wanted to say it quick and fast and get it in the mail. And so that's what we have. And of course, I believe that 2nd and 3rd John are every bit as inspired by the Holy Spirit as 1 John is. But these were written as personal notes to two different individuals. And I think that as we look at the content, especially here in 2 John today, we'll see why he was in such a hurry, why he was in such a rush to get this message in the mail. With all of that being said, 2 John also echoes many of the same themes as 1 John. And I think you'll see that in the 13 verses that we considered together. It's almost like a more personal, informal Cliff's Note version of 1 John. And you can definitely see the influence and the stamp of the author on this letter. So, with that being said, I want us to just look at how the letter starts. In 2 John, verse 1, it says, "The elder to the elect lady and her children." So, unlike 1 John, 2 John does start like a letter. It tells us who it's from and who it's to, but it's a little bit enigmatic. John calls himself the elder. He does this in 2 John and in 3 John, and I don't know if he means that in an official capacity, like he's serving as a pastor, overseer, elder in a local congregation, or if he just means that he is an older man. But certainly by the time that John wrote 2nd and 3rd John, he would have been older. And he takes on a very fatherly tone, much like he does in 1 John. Where the real debate comes in is about this business of the elect lady and her children. Who is that? And I'll just say that the majority view is that this is a personification of a local church. So in a poetic way, John is saying, "I'm writing to you, and the church that I'm with and the individual Christians that I'm with send greetings." That's the majority view, according to most people. And I will say also that that kind of language is used in other places. I'll just give you a quick example. In 1 Peter chapter 5, when Peter finishes this letter, he sends greetings from the people that are with him. And in 1 Peter 5 and verse 13, he says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings. And so does Mark my son." And in that instance, I do think that he is personifying the local church as a woman. He's saying that this church is sending greetings to you who are also chosen. However, when we look at 1 John, I actually lean towards the view that this is an individual woman with children. And I've got a few different reasons for that, and they're not really important, so I'm not going to get into that, so take it or leave it. But 3 John is definitely written to an individual man. His name is Gaius. 2 John appears to me to be written to an individual lady who has children. They probably are the host of the local church that he's writing to, but they're very influential, and he has concern for their souls. So that is all I have to say about the elder to the elect lady and her children. But let's get into the text of this letter. So I'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 4. The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. So right away, just in these first 4 verses, hopefully you can see what a major theme is for John in this letter. 5 times in these 4 verses, he uses the word truth. Truth is very much on John's mind and is something that he wants his readers to be thinking about. And there's probably a lot that we could say about that, that John talks so much about truth and what the nature of truth is. But I'll make 2 quick observations about that. The first is that truth exists. And I know that's very basic, and you're sitting there and you're thinking like, wow, that's super profound. Thanks for that. You know, but truth exists. And that is a point that is more and more debated today. In a society where everything is relative, to say that something is true can seem sort of closed-minded or backwards. And yet, that is very much the position that the Apostle John takes, that truth exists. It'd be hard for him to talk about truth if there was no such thing as truth. It'd be hard for him to talk about truth if everything was relative. And Jesus also talks like that. You know, when Jesus was before Pilate in John chapter 18, John 18 and verse 37, he said, "For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And so, according to Jesus, truth is found in his words. If we listen to Jesus, we're listening to truth, and we can know, we can take that to the bank, that it is true. But a second observation that I'll make, and I think that this is more pertinent to this particular letter, is that truth creates unity. Truth creates unity. As we just observed in John chapter 18, when Jesus is before Pilate, he talks about how he came into the world to bear witness to the truth. But as he said, everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Truth has that effect. That when people listen to the truth, when people conform to the truth, when people let the truth shape them and mold them, it creates a group of people who are unified, a group of people who are bound together by that truth. And so as you see right here in the text, in verses 1 and 2, John says to the elect lady and her children that he loves them in truth, as all who know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. And in verse 3, this relationship comes from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. And so that's why in verse 4, he rejoices that they're walking in the truth, because truth is what is binding them together. And I'll also remind us of what Jesus prayed in John chapter 17. In John chapter 17, this is exactly the kind of thing that Jesus wanted for his people. As he was praying not only for his disciples that were there with him in the first century before his crucifixion, he goes on to pray for those who will come after them, people like us. And in John 17 and verse 16, he says, "They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world, and for their sake I consecrate myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth. I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me." And so Jesus very much vocalized this idea that there is truth, and that truth is found in the Word of God, and that furthermore, that it has this unifying effect. That if we will all listen to the truth and conform to the truth and obey the truth, that it is the truth that will bind us together and make us a group of people who are united. And when you think about it, it has to be like that. Because if there was no truth and everything was relative, we couldn't really ever have unity at all. I mean, think about it like this. You know, if you saw the way that I lived and the way that I thought, and you thought, like, some of that makes sense, and I'm going to change to live and think like you. Well, what if I'm looking at somebody else and I say, well, I think that the way that they live and the way that they think makes sense, and so I'm going to change to live and think like them. And then maybe that person looks to somebody else and they're doing the same thing, and we're constantly changing, but none of us are arriving anywhere. We're all just sort of in constant fluctuation. I've used this analogy before, and I'll use it again. But it's kind of like if you wanted to tune a room full of pianos. Imagine you had a room full of pianos, and they were all slightly out of tune. So you had this idea that the way you're going to get all the pianos to sound the same is you go from the first piano to the second one, and you say, I'm going to make the second one sound like the first one. And then once you got that right, you go to the third piano and you say, I'm going to make the third one sound like the second one. And you were to go around the room and do that for all 100 pianos. It's kind of like the game of telephone, you know? If you're a little bit off every time, by the time you get to piano number 100, it's going to sound nothing like piano number one. But the way that you could actually get a room full of 100 pianos to all sound the same is if you had a common standard that you took to each one. If you had a pitch pipe or a tuning fork or something like that, you could go to each piano and tune it to that standard. And it's that objective standard that if they're all conforming to the same thing, that they're all becoming more and more not only like that thing, but also more and more like each other. And they're unified by it. And so objective truth is important. And because there is joy when we have unity, there is joy when we walk in the truth. And that's what John is setting up for us here. Now, all of that's going to be really important as we see the crisis that he's addressing later on in this book. But I want us to see that. That number one, there is truth. And number two, truth creates unity. Let's go ahead and move on to verses 5 and 6. In verse 5, he says, "And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it." Now, if the first theme of 2 John is truth, the second theme of 2 John is love. And these verses that we've just read should sound very, very familiar to us for a couple of different reasons. First of all, they're very reminiscent of 1 John chapter 2, verses 7 through 10. In 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 7, this is what he wrote in 1 John. "Beloved, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you have heard. At the same time, it is a new commandment that I am writing to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away, and the true light is already shining. Whoever says he is in the light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light, and in him there is no cause for stumbling." So there in 1 John chapter 2, verses 7 through 10, John is using that same kind of language. I'm writing to you about this new commandment, but it's not really a new commandment. It's actually the old commandment that you heard from the beginning, but there's something new about it. He doesn't tell us explicitly what it is in 1 John, although I think it's pretty clearly implied. But the other place that this should remind us of is the place that tells us explicitly what it is. And that's John chapter 13. And I think that this is what John is referencing. It's the words of Jesus in John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. In John chapter 13 and verse 34, Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And so the new commandment is very much what we talked about this morning, is to love one another. And the reason why it's not really a new commandment is because God had told his people that way back in Leviticus chapter 19, that they should love their neighbors as themselves. But Jesus says, "I'm personifying this thing for you in a way that is so transformative that it's almost like a totally new thing." Like, if you're going to learn to love people the way that I love people, it's a totally new idea. It's a totally new concept. Now, what we see here in 2 John is that there's a connection between these two themes. There's a connection between truth and love. And John's point is that truth and love are actually inseparable. It's because God commands us to do it. See? God commands us to love each other. And so we can't be walking in the truth or walking according to his commandments if we're not walking in love. If that's what we think that we're doing, we're fooling ourselves. You know, if we're saying, well, we're keeping all the rules and we're making sure we stay in the guidelines and we're checking all the boxes, but we're not walking in love, then we're not actually walking according to his commandments. And so if we depart from truth, we depart from love. And if we depart from love, we also depart from truth. Same thing back in 1 John chapter 4. In 1 John chapter 4, he uses the same kind of conversation. 1 John 4 and verse 20. "If anyone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother." On into chapter 5, "Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves whoever has been born of him. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and obey his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." And so, what John is saying at the beginning of 2 John is that he is really glad to find that this elect lady and her children are really keeping God's commandments. They're actually walking in truth. They're actually walking in love. They're living out the gospel, see? It reminds me of what Paul says in Galatians 5:25. He says, "If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit." That's what these people are doing in 2 John. The love of God is not something that just saved them and that was it and they moved on, but the love of God is something that is continuing to change them and shape them and guide them. And so the fact that they're walking in the truth means that they're walking in love. They're living out the gospel by loving one another. And it's with all those things in mind that as we come to verse 7, we see why this note is so urgent that it gets to this lady. In verse 7, John goes on to write, "For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting. For whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works." So now we see why this letter is so urgent, and we also see why John has been focusing so much on the truth. Because the truth is being threatened. Or at least, these people's foundation or acceptance in the truth is being threatened. John says that many deceivers have gone out into the world, and so the recipients of this letter need to be on the alert. Now, if we could compare this back to 1 John again, I think it would be helpful for us. Go back to 1 John chapter 2. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18, John wrote, "Children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out that it might become plain that they all are not of us." Now, when we were in 1 John, we talked in a little bit of detail about this idea of these false teachers being antichrist. And John is not concerned about a singular individual raising himself up as the antichrist, capital A. He's concerned about these multiple teachers who are preaching messages that are against Christ. In fact, he says in verse 18 that many antichrists have come. But if you notice in 1 John, he says that these false teachers have gone out from us, though they were not of us. Most people think that when John wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, that he wrote them from Ephesus. That is the universally traditional viewpoint. And so I think what's going on is that these false teachers have gone out from Ephesus, and John is saying in 1 John, they don't really represent the truth. I want you to know that they don't really represent the teaching that we are teaching from Jesus Christ. But now in 2 John, he's warning people that might encounter them. Now he's warning this elect lady, and he's saying, hey, if they come knocking on your door, you need to know that their message is not from Christ. Their message is actually anti-Christ. It is against Christ. Now, the particular deception that these false teachers are making is that Jesus Christ did not come in the flesh. He says that in verse 7. They do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. That's actually the exact same kind of false teaching that he talked about in 1 John. In 1 John chapter 4 and verse 2, that's exactly the deception there as well. And again, we talked about this when we were back in 1 John, but I think that they were teaching that Jesus was not actually the Son of God who came from heaven and lived on earth, but Jesus was this man who was sort of like anointed as the Son of God. The Christ came upon him, and then the Christ left him before he died, because it's ridiculous to think that the Son of God would actually die on the cross. And so the idea is that Jesus Christ didn't come in the flesh. He was just a man who was temporarily anointed as the Christ, but then that anointing was taken away from him before his death. Sort of a strange kind of teaching. But John says that's not at all the truth of the gospel. Jesus was not temporarily anointed as the Christ. Jesus Christ came in the flesh. He came from God. He is the pre-existent God who took on flesh. Now, with that being said, I want us to focus on their responsibilities in verses 8 through 11. So John is concerned that these false teachers are going out, and he tells this elect lady and her children, you need to pay attention and take some actions. And in verse 8, the first thing that he tells them to do is watch yourselves. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. So the first thing that John says is that when false teaching comes along, and it does, is that you need to keep watch on yourself. You need to make sure that you don't get swept up into this. When you've got people around you that are starting to believe false things and do false things and act in ways that do not please God, you need to watch yourself. Make sure you don't fall into that same trap. and get swept up into it. But what I want us to notice is that the first responsibility here is self-ward. Watch yourself. You know, sometimes it's easier for us to watch out for others than it is to watch out for ourselves. Sometimes it's easier for us to recognize how other people might not be thinking the right way, or they might have some lapse in their knowledge or their understanding or their judgments, and it's easy for us to judge them. And those are opportunities for us to reach out in love and try to help those people. But John says the first thing you need to do is to watch out for yourself. You know, we all have blind spots. There are probably ways that all of us need to grow and need to think about what we believe and why we believe it. And so the first responsibility is self-ward. Watch yourself. But then verse 9 also helps us to understand where we might go wrong. You know, there's different ways that false teaching might deceive us, that we might end up believing and teaching and doing things that don't please God. And in verse 9, he says, everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Sometimes we might end up being in error because we haven't gone as far as the teaching of Christ requires. Sometimes Christ calls us to do things that are difficult. And so the temptation is we don't want to go quite that far, and so we stop short. But sometimes maybe we're tempted to say we don't think the teaching of Christ goes far enough. And so we need to heap on our own ideas and maybe our own traditions and things like that and expect that everybody else conforms to those as well. And what we've done at that point is we've gone on ahead of the teaching of Christ. We've added to it. I think it's helpful for us to think that way because really our aim is to speak exactly where God has spoken, right? Let's not be people who are liberal where God is strict. And let's not be people who are strict where God is liberal. There are places where God gives liberty and judgment, and there are places that God is clear about what he expects and what he wants. And so if we are going to abide in the teaching of the Father and the Son, if that's where we're going to make our camp, is we're going to stay there within the teaching of the Father and the Son, it means that we don't go beyond it and we don't stop short of it. That we are as conservative as God requires and as liberal as God allows. I want to remind us of what Jesus said in John chapter 8. In John chapter 8, Jesus spoke about truth and his word. And he said it says in John chapter 8, in verse 31. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You see, he's using that same kind of language here that John is using in 2 John. He talks about abiding in his word. Don't go beyond it. Don't stop short of it. Make sure you do all of it. Speak where God has spoken. Be silent where God has been silent. If you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples. But he goes on to say in verse 32 that you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. How does that work? How is it that knowing the truth sets you free? Well, one way that I think that is true is because truth is always truth, you know? Like if you know the truth, you know something that's never going to change. You can take it to the bank. You're not going to wake up tomorrow and your truth has expired and it's no longer true. Like, if it's true today, it's still going to be true tomorrow. If it was true 2,000 years ago, it's still true today. In 2 John, remember what he said back in verse 2? He says, the truth that abides in us will be with us forever. Truth never expires. If something is true, it's always true. And it's kind of like what we talked about earlier, that without truth, right and wrong is a moving target. You know, what might be acceptable today might not be acceptable tomorrow. And what might not be acceptable today might become acceptable tomorrow. And so without truth, we are enslaved to the ever-changing whims of the people around us, constantly trying to conform to what society tells us is good or bad or right or wrong. And so then that's where conflicts and divisions come from, because people have different ideas about what's good and bad and what's right and wrong, and they disagree about it. But truth solves all of that, because everyone who abides in the teachings of Christ has unity. Remember, that's what he said in verse 3. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in truth and love. And so truth creates unity, and truth sets us free. It helps us to realize that when we know something, we can know it for sure, and we can know it forever. And we're not enslaved to the changing world around us. And so it's with all those things in mind that John tells these readers not to support anyone who's creating divisions through false teaching. And he gives some very specific directions in verses 10 and 11. He says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting. For whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Basically, what John is saying is if you encourage false teaching, if you support false teaching, then you have fellowship in that false teaching and you're guilty of it. That's a pretty serious kind of thing to keep in mind. So, is John saying that if the Mormons come and knock on your door, that you can't invite them in to sit at the table and talk? No, I don't think that's what he's saying. Is he saying that we can't have ongoing conversations with people that we have differences with or disagreements with? Is he saying, like, we can't have those conversations or we can't invite them to our home to have those conversations? No, that's not what he's saying. But he's saying you need to be very careful about the kind of teaching you promote. You need to be very careful about the kind of teaching you support, because if you have fellowship with teaching, God will hold you accountable for the quality and the effect of it. And so what does that mean for us? Well, I think it means for us, we need to be very careful about the kind of preaching that we promote and the kind of preaching that we support. We need to be careful about the preachers that we financially support. We need to make sure that they're teaching the truth as best we can. We have a responsibility to think about who we invite to come here and speak to the church. We need to have a reasonable belief and confidence in their ability to preach the truth. We need to be careful about the kinds of materials that we distribute, because false teaching is disruptive. And when we depart from the truth, we depart from the unity that we ought to have with each other in Christ. And so that's his major warning to them, is that when this false teaching comes, you need to, first of all, watch out for yourselves. And second of all, make sure that you're not supporting or encouraging the teaching of false doctrine. Now, that's the bulk of this letter, and now we have these last couple of verses. And this is the way John brings this note to a close. In verse 12, he says, though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face, so that our joy may be complete. The children of your elect sister greet you. So it seems like this message is urgent enough for John that he would rather get the message in the mail than delay by writing more. And he's made the decision, there's more that I could write, there's more that I want to write, but instead of writing it, I'm just going to go ahead and drop this in the mailbox. And I hope that we could actually have more conversation face-to-face. Instead of using paper and ink, he'd prefer to talk face-to-face. No matter how much technology might progress and change, there is always something special about talking face-to-face. I've got to say, I'm really thankful that we live in a day and age where I can use things like Zoom and FaceTime. Katie and I lived in San Francisco for 3 years, and we were away from our families, and we had a one-year-old Milo when we moved out there, and it was hard to be away from our parents. And Zoom and FaceTime and things like that were really special. But I'll tell you what, like, if I had FaceTimed my mom, like, the day before we flew back to Alabama, when we saw her in the airport, that didn't make her any less excited to see us, you know? Like, she still ran to us and put her arms around us and had tears in her eyes because she was excited to see us. And it wasn't like, oh, I just saw you on FaceTime last night, so, you know, what's up? But there's a certain specialness to being together in person. And maybe that would be important for us to remember as we think about being with one another. It might be important for us to remember if there is an important conversation that we need to have with somebody. There's a time and a place for writing a letter. There's a time and a place for sending a text message. There's a time and a place for even making a phone call. But there's a time and a place for saying, I want to meet in person. I want to look you in the eye. I want to talk. There's something special about that. It also might be good for us to think about when we're making decisions to assemble with the saints. You know, we might be tempted sometimes to just tune in online as a substitute for coming to Bible study, or as a substitute for actually being here for worship. And there are times when that can be a helpful tool for us, right? You know, every now and then, I guess a global pandemic happens, and we got to figure out what to do. Or maybe you're sick, or maybe you've had some kind of procedure done, or maybe for whatever reason you can't travel. Thank God that he's given us those blessings. But I want us to remember that those ought to be seen as temporary necessities and not permanent solutions. There's nothing that replaces being with one another face to face. There's nothing that replaces the encouragement that comes from that. And so, as we bring this letter to a close, the last line of it in verse 13 is that this woman's nieces and nephews apparently greet her as well. And John wants them to remember that as they walk in the truth, that their joy will be complete. And so, as we bring this lesson to a close, I hope that we've been able to see in this the importance of unity in the truth, and the joy that unity produces. And so really, that is the invitation that is being offered to anybody here tonight, is that you can enter into fellowship with God and with Christ. And in doing so, you not only enter into fellowship with God and with his son Jesus Christ, but you also enter into fellowship with all of his people. That as all of us are united in the truth, that you can be a part of that family. You can call God your father. You can have brothers and you can have sisters. We can labor side by side. We can work together. And we can glorify God in the way that we live. And so if you want to join us and share our joy, we invite you to be in fellowship with the Father. And if you know what you need to do because you're outside of fellowship with God and we can help you with that, we invite you to come to the front. Let us know while we stand together and sing the song.